Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. So, actually, let me ask you, is it a good afternoon? Yesterday, the US and Qatar announced a ceasefire tied to a sort of hostage deal, which may be the first indication that we have something to worry about. Why are the US and Qatar making this announcement? We'll get to that. The terms are strange. The first ones we knew about were 33 hostages to be released on Sunday, 10 of whom apparently are deceased. Why are we waiting till Sunday? What's going on? Where's the Red Cross? Then others will be released, tied to more aid going into Gaza. Although, if you saw what I saw, which is the videos of Gazans dancing in the streets with their cell phones, claiming victory in this war, looking anything like victims of some fictional genocide, you might wonder why they need more aid. The deal also seems to include a shift in the Israeli military position in Gaza. You can read the details, and the details are changing. But we are here to talk today about what Israelis have learned in the past 15 months about Hamas, about the PA, the future of Judea and Samaria and Gaza, about Lebanon and Syria, about Iran, about the US, and about hostages. And how strongly the Israelis feel about those lessons. Our guest today is Dan Diker, president of the Jerusalem Center for Security and Foreign Affairs, JCFA, which was formerly, as many of you know, the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Before we get to Dan, I will give you your JPC commercial. The Jewish Policy Center was founded in 1985 as a nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policies. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Most important today, and for the last 15 months, and for the last several years, we support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny those things. And more than ever now, we support the efforts of the government of Israel and the IDF to defend the people and the borders of Israel, all its borders, and when necessary, beyond the borders. We support justice in Gaza. That may include a hostage deal. It may start with a hostage deal, but it doesn't end there. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can read our insight articles and the new issue of our magazine, In Focus Quarterly, entitled Iran, Freedom or Fire. That is not a question. And now our guest, Dan Diker, is president of the Jerusalem Center for Security and Foreign Affairs, and he is the longtime director, excuse me, of its counter-political warfare program. We're going to ask him about.
Want to start? Are you? If you're going to start again, if you wouldn't mind introducing me,
Go ahead, Dan. Shoot.
are we jumping right in, or?
We're going to jump in. Go ahead. And then I'm going to ask you my question. So, Dan, say whatever you want to about your current position, and then we'll talk.
Look, I think. First of all, I'm delighted to join the Jewish Policy Center. I'm a fan and a follower and a contributor, and it's really a delight. It's extremely important because I heard you say they do Jewish Policy Center defends the legitimacy and the border security of the state of Israel, and I think I would say that Jerusalem Center for Security and Foreign Affairs defends the legitimacy of the United States. Now, why would I say such a thing? Because October the 7th, in the lessons learned. October the 7th was an assault on the United States and Israel over the borders of southern Israel. And I say that because it's become far too acceptable in the Western discourse to think, to understand that October the 7th was essentially a cry by a vilified Hamas victim that was, as the discourse goes, seeking freedom from an oppressive Israeli regime, when in fact, October the 7th was an expression of the Iranian regime's cry of death to America, death to Israel, that they that we heard in the streets of Tehran from since 1979, and in a sense climaxing on October 7th with the worst massacre, mass murder, mass rape, and torture and kidnapping of Israeli and nationals from 20 other countries that the world has seen has in the last number of decades. And I think it's very important to understand, Shoshana, that the conflict opposite jihadi Hamas that we face is the same conflict that America felt on 9/11 and subsequent to 9/11. This is a conflict that was immediately branded the Al-Aqsa flood, which is a reference, of course, to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, that is a yet again an affirmation of the religiously fueled, ideologically driven, determined erasure of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people in what the Islamists believe is Dar al-Islam, which is the world of Islam, which non-Muslims have no business having sovereignty. And in fact, October the 7th was a very bloody example of this ongoing war against the West, where Israel represents the West in the Middle East. It's not just a determination to destroy the Jews, but it's to destroy a concept. And it's a concept of the West in the Middle East that Hamas, its Iranian patrons, Hezbollah, Houthis, and many others around the Middle East that are loyal to the Iranian regime concept understand and are that the West has no place in the Middle East, certainly not in any kind of sovereign expression, and Israel is that. So that was a decision to destroy what they see as the West representative in the Middle East. And I think that unfortunately Israel did not see it coming. We clearly thought that Hamas was seeking greater international legitimization, and that Hamas had actually become a member of the society of upwardly mobile bourgeois former ideologues, and we underestimated the ideological and religious commitment of Hamas to the destruction of Israel. And we've learned in Israel very, very serious lessons that no political compromise, no territorial compromise will satisfy the appetite of this monstrous campaign to destroy Israel. And in short, Israel has readopted the concept of security first diplomacy, not diplomacy first security. And for so many decades, since the beginning of the Oslo Accords, the ill-fated and the ill-advised, and ultimately the bloody and deadly Oslo Accords between the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, and Israel, which was then carried forward by the artificially created PA, Palestinian Authority. It was that created the pathway that detonated on October the 7th. So Israel has, I can say and generalize to say that Israel, the Israeli political echelons, the Israeli public, the Israeli defense echelons have now formally rethought the Israeli national security concept that can best be summarized and packaged as defense and security first to any type of foreign policy decision that Israel's going to make. And Israel's not going to take chances on Western style Oslo type of, we will overcome kumbaya diplomatic initiatives. It's not going to happen.
So that put you at odds intellectually with several American administrations, including this last one. And Anthony Blinken made a speech yesterday in which he said, Israel will now benefit most by taking advantage of this opportunity. And Israel can't ignore the fact that there are Palestinians without a state, and Israel and Israel and Israel. And he is going on and on about the political possibilities that he seems to believe are opened up by this ceasefire deal. Now, the good news here is Anthony Blinken has 5 days left, and then things will change here. It's also true, Dan, as you say, that Hamas is a religious outpouring connected to Iran, and we saw it in the United States not as a religious outpouring. The globalized, the Intifada had no resonance here. People didn't understand what it meant. They were out there, and there were stupid college students yelling, "Globalize the Intifada." People didn't understand until New Year's. And on New Year's, when the truck blew up in New Orleans, and it was later understood that the guy who drove the truck and killed all those people had been speaking to an imam in Houston who had those same thoughts about globalizing the Intifada. And it suddenly seemed to have connected here in a way that it hadn't before. And so I think we have an opportunity here between Israel reevaluating its security situation and its parameters and what it's willing to do and not willing to do, a new understanding, perhaps, in the American public about what those people were talking about when they said globalize the Intifada, and a change of administration in which you have people who are fundamentally, shouldn't use that word, right, who are opposed to what it is that Hamas stands for and opposed to what it is that Iran stands for. Chief among them being Marco Rubio, who will undoubtedly become the Secretary of State if you listen to him talk about Hamas. I think he gets it. So we may be embarking on a moment of more contiguity between what you all think and what we all think. I don't know where it's going to go, but it's been a while, I think, since the Israelis and the Americans have been on perhaps the same page. And so now explain that if you don't go to the two-state, if you can get rid of the two-state solution, and there are so many people that still do believe in it, the establishment, because Anthony Blinken's probably going to go to the Atlantic Council or Brookings, or he's still going to, Dennis Ross is still doing the two-state solution. If you go security first, what are Israel's priorities?
Well, you've asked so many good questions under one large umbrella. It's very, very important to address each of these components. And because, and I say it seriously, you've really asked all the key questions under one large theme, and that is, first of all, the growing similarities in understanding between Israelis on, Ben Yehuda Street, both in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem. And in, people on Main Street, whether it's in Princeton, New Jersey, or whether it's in on Pennsylvania Avenue in where you are in town. And this notion of globalize the Intifada, on the face of it, sounds bizarre, because the word Intifada had only been used in the very specific context of Israel. And the Western media, Western political class had referred to the Intifada as the, which means in Arabic, the throwing off of the resistance of the throwing off the yoke of oppression. And that had been uniquely reserved for Israel, when in fact it's not about Israel at all. It's about the perception of colonialism. It's the perception of the rejection of Judeo-Christian civilization. And that is exactly what Osama bin Laden might have said on 9/11, where when he was busy blowing up the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, is globalized. It's what he did. He globalized the Intifada. Unfortunately, I should have realized back in 1980, when Tony Blinken and I were classmates at Harvard College, and we were speaking in French about his experience of anti-Semitism in Paris, that he would then come to really embody the so many in the European political class that see what's happening between jihadi Hamas, jihadi Hezbollah, their patrons in Tehran and Israel, as a function of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Meaning, what Tony Blinken understood as a young Harvard freshman in 1980 is what he still misunderstands today at the age of 62 when he talks about Palestinian statehood or the possibility for Palestinian political resolution. In simple terms, if I could say to my friend Anthony Blinken, we are not in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. We are facing a global jihad that Osama bin Laden and his ilk on the Sunni side and Grand Ayatollah Khomeini and his successor Ali Khamenei remind us every single day on the extremist or radical Shiite side that this is a war of civilization versus barbarism. It's a war of civilization versus savagery. It has nothing to do with land per se or with borders per se. Unfortunately, that narrative that what happened to Israeli women in the mass rape, torture, and kidnapping was due to a political complaint or grievance, we have to wipe that out of the intellectual and moral understanding of people in the West. And perhaps, as you said so eloquently and so poignantly, what happened on the 31st of December in New Orleans is exactly what happened on October the 7th. It is one globalized jihad against Western values, against Western people, against the Western way of life, against Judeo-Christian civilization. And it's very uncomfortable for people, I believe, in the West to consider that they are being targeted by a religious, ideologically fueled commitment to destruction. It just is, it is not the American way. The American way is let's split it down the middle, apple pie, Chevrolet, compromise, you take half, we take half, win-win, we're all happy. It's simply not the way the Middle East works. And if, as the great Professor Bernard Lewis of blessed memory tried to teach us in so many instances, we cannot mirror what he called mirroring. Professor Lewis meant superimposing the way Western people think on the Arab, Muslim, Middle East. It doesn't work. And if we keep doing that and thinking that creating another Palestinian state, that in this case might be in Judea and Samaria, overlooking Ben Gurion Airport, 3,000 feet above sea level, we are going to pave the road to the next October 7th, which will be driven by a Hamas-controlled West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, as it's called in the Israeli discourse. 3,600 years of history here. We will not commit suicide over, this entire issue that's called fighting jihad. And therefore, that's why we say that one of the most important lessons of October 7th, you stated very well in your opening remarks, we have to understand that in the United States, in Europe, and in Israel, we are all facing the same jihadistic enemy. And we've got to fight it as people, as women and men of goodwill, of moral clarity, and not convince ourselves that if we retreat and compromise in territory in the Middle East, that is considered an act of cowardice, an act of weakness, and an act that invites a greater assault upon you and your sovereignty.
So from the Israeli point, here again, there are times that we're at the same place, but we do it differently. In Israel, the question is about territory. So you just said, and correctly, I think, if you cede territory, they just see that as the next step for more territory. Now, in the United States, it doesn't work that way. Nobody wants our territory. Well, they do, but never mind. We have a feeling that we can buy what we want. The goal is the same, to believe that people have the same end game that we have. We have the end game. Americans want peace, they want security, they want food for their families, they want a job, they want, whatever it is that we want. Israelis, I do think, by the way, want the same thing: peace, security, whatever. We believe that we can buy that. We believe that you can buy it by giving territory. We believe that we can buy it financially. But if you look at Afghanistan, we did a hideous thing in Afghanistan in 2021. We ran out on people who depended on us. And the Taliban said, "Don't worry about it. We're going to be nice this time. We're not going to be terrorists. We're going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine." So, what have they done since 2021? The women can't go to school. The women can't go out in the street. The women can't have their voices go out the windows. Now you have to have a window in Afghanistan. So it removes the possibility that a woman's voice will get out from the hole where the window should be. We have given them well over $1 billion in foreign aid in the last 3 years, because we thought that if they ate and they could support their families, they would be nice. They're not nice. They're not nice. They're not nice to the women. They're not nice to, and they're not nice. And you have the same problem in the Middle East. We are just getting there. Unfortunately, I hate to say it, you got there faster because more Israelis, unfortunately, have been killed. But I'm hoping that maybe we're on the same track and that we stop feeding these people, we stop giving them money. So that would be a question, sort of, about the future of Gaza. And what I saw in the video, did you see the video of them dancing in the
Yeah,
sky?
the Gazan people celebrating the Hamas victory over Israel video.
Yes, that one. So they're holding up their cell phones and they look happy and they look quite healthy and they look well fed. And I would say, I don't believe we should feed them. In the deal, apparently, is more humanitarian aid. Why? Why?
The outgoing administration, the Biden administration, has believed that increasing humanitarian aid is a fundamental responsibility of Israel, which it is not, according to international. We have no requirement to feed an enemy population that, by the way, by the hundreds participated in the atrocities of October 7th. The prospective increase, the demanded increase as part of the Hamas hostages for ceasefire arrangement includes this increase in humanitarian aid, which strengthens, empowers, and emboldens the Hamas control over Gaza, in fact weakens Israel's position simultaneously. So it is rather extraordinary that the current administration has fashioned the humanitarian crisis around a perceived lack of humanitarian aid, or what, there was a spin called starvation, weaponization of starvation, which was complete nonsense from the very beginning. There has never been anything near starvation in Gaza unless the Hamas caused it and weaponized it and used it for PR purposes. You know that Professor Richard Landis, by the way, formerly of Boston University, currently domiciled in Israel, has become the expert in what is known as the Hamas and PLO version of Hollywood, which they call Pollywood. And that concept of Pollywood, which means fake and artificially created scenes of bloodshed and victimization, which is all completely has been completely manufactured for international and Al Jazeera and the American network's consumption, has really done a job on the cognitive, on the perception of Western media and Western influencers, even Western governments in looking at this particular conflict. This has been one of the most dangerous outcomes of this conflict. I call it iPhone warfare. And the Hamas have become experts in iPhone warfare, in creating what they learned from the Soviets, because the Soviets were the sponsors of the PLO, and the PLO were the teachers of the Hamas, together with Iran, on the issues of cognitive warfare, perception warfare, political warfare, psychological warfare. These came out of the halls of the Chinese Communist Party, of the Soviets themselves, and this is exactly what is happening now in terms of the export of this fake, what they call Gazawood, Pollywood, a type of manufactured perceptions, in order to isolate Israel, to condemn Israel. And they appear, Shoshana, apparently the Hamas and their Iranian masters have been successful at this, because look at the ICC and the ICJ. they want to arrest young Israeli women and men who are on vacation skiing, whether it's in Europe or vacationing in Thailand. You have 12 countries that have now adopted the ICJ proposition of arresting young Israelis on war crime, on these manufactured war crime accusations. So it looks like the cognitive warfare aspect of this entire atrocity that has been promoted and executed by the Hamas has made useful idiots of very otherwise intelligent people in the West.
No, it's actually just more of the same. If you think that or you're willing to say that the Palestinians just want whatever it is you think they're supposed to want, they just want peace, they just want a home, they just want food. If you believe that, all the rest of it doesn't make any difference. Well, the whole problem is they don't have what they want, you know? They don't understand that what those people want is not what you think they want. They don't agree with you about the needs of the people. And when you get to that point, then you understand there's no satisfying the Palestinian needs and desires except by killing yourself or killing us or whatever. But the ICJ is made up of some very venal people, including the ICC justice who was running for president of Lebanon at the same time that he was conducting war crimes trials against Israel. There are some venal people. But there are an awful lot of people who'd say, well, look, if you would just give them, if you would just let them have some of what they want, then they'll be nicer. If you can't uproot that thought, you can't make progress in any of the other things. So, number one, first question, how come Israel is so bad at this? Question 1A, how come the United States is so bad at this? We're terrible at understanding motivation. We are terrible at understanding Pollywood, Gaza Wood, whatever it is. And a lot of that, by the way, is Photoshop. A lot of that is really unfortunate photographs from the Syrian civil war. And they just, say, okay, this is Palestinians. And no, it wasn't Palestinians, it was Aleppo. What do we do to fix this? How do we get a handle on this?
To get a handle on it means to, first of all, expose it, understand it, expose it, educate ourselves and our fellow travelers and the world about it, and then engage people in terms of what how we really need to understand the Middle East and how we really understand pragmatic pathways. And I say pragmatic and practical because the concept of, well, to get to a more peaceful a set of data points. Because, when Barack Obama, President Obama, stood before Al-Azhar University in 2009, and the first thing he said to three rows of Muslim Brotherhood authorities in the first three rows, he said, Wassalamu alaykum. That was the first thing he said. And I remember asking Professor Lewis, who had visited Jerusalem very soon after, how did the educators and the imamim of the Muslim Brotherhood organization sitting in the first three rows in that Al-Azhar University in Cairo, how did they understand President Obama? And Professor Lewis said, and this is on the record, you can see this on Google, you can just Google it. He said, well, they only could understand him as a fellow Islamist, as a fellow Muslim. And I said, well, that's fascinating. And he said, yes, because in the West, you think that shalom, salam, and peace all mean the same things, but they don't. It means submission in Arabic. Wassalamu alaykum means submission to Allah uniquely, and that wasn't what the West thinks when they address the Arab Muslim Middle East. It doesn't mean the same things. So the way we have to handle it is by understanding the political culture of the area, the political culture of this part of the world, and don't superimpose your culture and your understanding on their culture and their understanding, because you're going to come up short. What it means in terms of lessons learned, in terms of a Palestinian state, means to listen to what they're actually saying. Don't listen. We've been listening to ourselves, our own Western echo chamber, about give them what they want. What we're really saying, Shoshana, is no, let's give them what we want for them. It's not what they want, because if we listen carefully to what they want. Let's listen in Arabic. Nobody talks about a Palestinian state. Nobody talks about a Palestinian state. They don't talk about a Palestinian state. They talk about eliminating the Jewish state. That's what they talk about. And even people who come from a positive impulse, when you ask in Palestinian polls that are mostly conducted by Professor Shkaki, a US-trained pollster who got the elections in 2006 completely wrong, thinking that the so-called moderate Fatah was going to win when the Hamas actually won. And you ask people what they want, Palestinian state is way down on the list. Many people they want education, they want economy, they want to be able to travel to their families in Jordan and in Egypt and in Yemen and throughout the Middle East. Nobody's talking about a Palestinian state. So that is just a good example of Westerners wanting for Palestinians what Palestinians are not even talking about for themselves.
Okay, got to stop there because you said something important. Assuming that the Palestinians are telling Shukaki the truth about what they want and the state is low on the list and these other things are higher on the list, where does the destruction of the state of Israel fit on their list? We have trouble understanding whether or not there is a Palestinian civilian population that is anti-Hamas. That is anti the corruption of the Palestinian Authority, that would like to have a life that includes education and travel in Jordan and all those other things. Where does the destruction of Israel rate in those polls?
Well, I would say the destruction rates, if those polls were to be conducted today, I think that the destruction of Israel would rate or would come in much lower, because notwithstanding this very problematic deal opposite the Hamas that, as we speak, is sort of being either extorted by Hamas for more and more and more, and is sort of being worked out. Israel today is considered the strong horse in the Middle East. After September 2024 and the beeper bombs, and the subsequent killing of Sinwar, the Hamas leader, to be Yahya Sinwar, to be followed by and Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of the Hezbollah, as well as completely stripping the Iranian regime of its air defenses and other sensitive penetration of other sensitive sites by the Israeli Air Force. Israel is considered today the strong horse. And the stronger Israel is, the more Palestinians and Arabs across the region want a connection with Israel. And the less they call for the destruction of Israel.
So that makes sense to me. When I think about Abraham Accords countries, and I think about Saudi Arabia, who's not an Abraham Accords country, a lot of other countries, including Jordan, for example. But when you watch those guys dancing in the street last night in Gaza, screaming about victory, and the speech that one of the Hamas leadership made in Qatar today about praising October 7th, and it was only the first. October 7th, there will be many more October 7ths, he said. It's hard to reconcile what I think we think of as Arab countries that can be dealt with, who do need Israel as a strong horse, who like, they may not like it, but they accept the concept of Israel as a strong horse, and Palestinian people in the streets who I think may want something else. Is there a big split between Palestinians and other Arabs?
That's a very good question. I think that the answer is yes. I mean, when we say other Arabs, I think we have to say which Arabs are we talking about, because I think that the Arab and Muslim world defines itself by tribe, family, and clan. And we know that I remember I know traveling through Judea and Samaria and actually going to certain Arab villages that don't even speak to the Arab village on the other side of the fence or the down the street. In other words, it's really, it's very much a clan family based culture. So, but the Palest remember the Palestinian street erupted in this sort of Super Bowl type of hysteria, if you will, lahavdil, many differences between the cultures, but when they realized that Israel had been bloodied, because in this particular, look what happened on 9/11. There were celebrations on the streets of Gaza, celebrations across the West Bank on 9/11, as the buildings were still burning. So it is this notion that we can bloody Israel that we can weaken Israel, weaken the West, weaken the United States, that causes celebration in the streets of Judea and Samaria and in the Arab-controlled areas of Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, and in Gaza and in other places. So when the reason you saw celebrations is that when the deal calls for three kidnapped victims to be freed per week, it's kind of like bleeding Israel, if you will, with its own hostages down this, you know, 7 week a 7 week long process that makes Israel look very weak, that makes Hamas look strong and in control. And in fact, this deal does fashion Hamas as stronger and Israel as bloodied and weaker. And as we said today in a discussion with General Yossi Kuperwasser on a JCFA brief, what Hamas has successfully done is to take the last major principal payment of the October 7th massacre in this deal, because this deal is more like Ben Shapiro talked about it today. It's more like a criminal mafia organization demanding a hostage price in a hostage negotiation than it is between two sides that are exchanging prisoners, you know, as armies have done in military history. But this is really the deal. This is kind of like the Sopranos determining for the U.S. government when how we handle organized crime. It's absurd. But it is a source of glory and momentary excitement for the street in Gaza that really are furious, many with Hamas, that has destroyed their homes, destroyed their future, destroyed their lives. And so here the Hamas has fashioned itself as hero as opposed to as oppressor by causing the Jews to bleed, and people get sort of a temporary high out of it.
So, very important thing you said. You said a moment of glory and you said a temporary high. Is it going, a couple questions come to mind. Is it going to fade? But if it does fade, is it going to come back again when something else happens? And secondly, is a possible approach to this to ensure that Hamas doesn't look like the winner? They look like the winner this morning. But if they are not controlling what happens in Gaza afterwards, all those people who were hungry and blamed Hamas and did have their homes destroyed and blamed Hamas are going to go back to blaming Hamas? Maybe if the food does not come through Hamas and the reconstruction doesn't come through Hamas, maybe that we can extend that period in which they're angry with Hamas. I don't know.
The only way to defeat Hamas is to destroy Hamas. There's no other way. And this particular arrangement strengthens the Hamas. That's the fundamental violation of the commitment of Prime Minister Netanyahu to what they call total victory. And it's my sense that this is just a small, in American terms, painful sixth inning stretch in a much longer war. That in which, in the end, Israel will destroy the Hamas, and it will do it with American moral clarity and American help. If we watched Hegseth and Rubio and Waltz in their confirmation hearings, all of them are talking about destroying the Hamas. We have not heard that from three major officials of the U.S. government ever, even since 9/11. And well, because
they're not confirmed yet, all three of them. They're not officials yet. Just hang on.
Not yet, but on the way. On the way. I'd be very hard-pressed to see them not be confirmed, at least two of the three of them.
Well, Rubio, for sure. There's not a question. Waltz, more than likely. Hegseth, who made a really fine statement yesterday. We have to wait and see. But I don't want to talk about American politics. Your point is well taken. There is a difference of opinion. But what you're really saying is, this is not a permanent agreement. This may not even be a long-lasting agreement. And I would point out for our listeners, this is not the first ceasefire that Israel has had with Hamas. There was a ceasefire on October 6, 2023. They were living under the rules of a ceasefire.
But they were living under the rules of the Hudna, not ceasefire. Ceasefire for us at the Jewish Policy Center, the Jerusalem Center for Security and Foreign Affairs, is not the concept that the Hamas or the PLO or the Hezbollah or fellow travelers understand. So for
That's
them,
right.
it was only a temporary cessation of fire.
That's really important to understand because we have seen this game before where there's a ceasefire, or what we call a ceasefire, because it's always engineered by us anyway, by the United States, and Israel agrees. And then Hamas or whoever says yes, they agree also, but they don't really agree. They agree for as long as it works for them, and then it's over. So we need to keep that in mind. Now, let's go back to the starting point of this conversation, which is how do Israelis see this? You wake up in Tel Aviv this morning, or yesterday morning, I suppose, or you wake up in Jerusalem, or you wake up in the north of Israel, where you have different kinds of problems, but similar problems. How do you feel? Do you feel betrayed? Do you feel like you can work with this? Do you feel like hostages were betrayed? I mean, there are some people who believe that the IDF has been fighting for 15 months to get them back. And a lot of young soldiers have died, and this is a horrible thing. And it's the great tragedy of Israel is the number of young people who have died in this. Are they betrayed? How do Israelis see all of this? Or don't we know yet?
We do. We see it through various glasses. We see them through sunglasses, where in which the light, the positive light of hope and optimism, shine very brightly. And we also see them with prescription glasses that help us see much more clearly things that we refuse to see because we were willfully blind to what was threatening us. Declaratively, and what was in front of our faces is a major strategic, if not existential, threat. And so, when we open up the pages of Israel's daily newspapers and see another three and four young men and sometimes women who have fallen in battle for the security and existence of the state of Israel, it creates a tremendous sense of sadness and also anger that we didn't see it coming earlier, and that we haven't successfully defeated this enemy after 15 months. I mean, this is not the Turkish army or the Russian army or the Chinese army. This is 50,000 terrorists who live in a very small area, 2,000 kilometers in total. And after 15 months, the strongest army, the superpower of the Middle East, was not able to completely destroy a terrorist organization, which teaches us something about the way war is conducted in 2024 in terms of urban warfare. As John Spencer has been helpful, and the head of urban warfare at West Point has been so helpful in helping us understand how asymmetrical warfare is fought, and the other, I think the other pain point, if you will, in Israel is that we hadn't returned the hostages. We hadn't returned Israelis whose lives had been entrusted to the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, and we were not able to free them from the dungeons of Hamas captivity. And this is a tremendous source of suffering for Israelis, no matter where your political views are. And the only the very difficult and tension-filled discussion in the body politic, in the public discourse, is how you free them. It's not if you free them, but it's a balance sheet of liabilities and assets, and whether in fact do you endanger millions of Israelis by freeing thousands of terrorists that have blood on their hands, mass murder, convicted, imprisoned, 50. They want 50. The current deal causes 40 to 50 terrorists for every individual hostage, man or woman, released. That type of ratio is just simply impossible to countenance, and that's what we deal with. And at the end of the day, in Jewish morality, Jewish ethics, the saving of one life is if you saved an entire world. And we haven't made good on that until this particular moment, perhaps.
And I would point out that there's also a Mishnah, and I'm not claiming to be a Jewish scholar, but I have been shown this, that says not to overpay for captives because it will encourage the taking of more captives. And so that's your point. You know, if we really, if you release 3,000 terrorists, now not all of them are the upper level, you know, some of them are lower level security people, but if you release 3,000 of them, what do you get? Without ever trying to lay blame on Gilad Shalit. Among those that Israel released for him was Yahya Sinwar. And so maybe there's a question about what's the point at which you say, I can't do this because I'm trading essentially a current captive for a future captive. Is that part of the discourse in Israel?
Absolutely. That's exactly the argument that one side of the discourse makes, is that I'm trading one captive today for a possibility of a free and fighting terrorist that can cause many, many more deaths in the future than what we have today. So this is exactly the discussion, and it's a very painful and difficult discussion. That has led us through these 15 months. And the fact is that we haven't even been able to locate many of these people, and they've been murdered inside in Hamas captivity. The Red Cross has said nothing. International human rights groups have said nothing. And so here, Israelis feel alone, very much fighting, punching above their weight as much as possible. We're a small people. We're 10 million people total, with the largest, most vibrant Arab minority of any country relative to our size, with the same exact rights, and who themselves were kidnapped and killed on October 7th. So that, by the way, is a side point, has created much more identification, I think, and sense of shared destiny between Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews. An important point, not central to the discussion we're having, but a very important point, that we're seeing a greater melding of a Israeli civic identity around the fact that all of us were on Hamas's target list on October 7th. And if you look at the papers, if you go to jcpa.org and read the extraordinary uncovering analysis by Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Doa Halevi of what Hamas had intended to do, was 20 times worse than what they actually did, including the massacre of these young people at the Nova Music Festival on Simchat Torah and Shabbat. They really intended to cut Israel in three, together with the Hezbollah in the north, all backed by Iran, and really, call and attempt the destruction of this very small country the size of Maryland.
So, you know, it's very unusual for me to disagree with you. Maybe it's never happened in all the years we've known each other, but you said that it was not a central point, the role of Arab Israelis and how they feel and their perhaps awakened sense of Israeli-ism. It's a central point. And one of the reasons it's a central point, in my view, is that when you talk about the larger area and what happens to Palestinians who, after four, five, six generations, still think of themselves as refugees. But there is a community of Arab Israelis who are not refugees and who don't think of themselves as refugees. If you've got to deal with people over here and here, the people here are central to that conversation. They are the model for what people in Judea and Samaria and Gaza could have been and could still be. I'm not as citizens of Israel, perhaps, but not as refugees. And so I think they're central. And to ignore them, and by the way, one of the reasons that I raise this right now is that Anthony Blinken's speech yesterday talked about stateless Palestinians and talked about Israelis without recognizing that 20% of the state of Israel is comprised of citizens who are not Jewish. So I think it's central. And I think you have to go there because if you could have what they have, would you be happy is a question. And I think it's a question that people will respond to. So let
Well, it's
me.
true. Well, first of all, I'm not sure that we disagree. I think we actually agree, even though I was just trying to be I was just trying to be a disciplined a participant in our conversation, not to stray too far.
I want you
But
to.
you're right. I mean, first of all, we at the Jerusalem Center for Security and Foreign Affairs have differentiated ourselves by bringing in Arab scholars and Syrian scholars. My friend Hazim Algebra, if you look at the Jerusalem Post and Israel Hayom from this week, is all over. As a matter of fact, if you look at him today, he's a strong part of our team, and he came from Washington, D.C., in order to remind us that Israeli Arab men and women are absolutely critical to this discussion about the future of the Middle East, of Israel and the Middle East. And in fact, Hazem pointed out to me today that the story really is about the Khaled Abu Toames, the great Israeli Arab journalist who is a scholar here at the JCFA, and many other young women and men who study at the Technion, who are leaders in industry, leaders in medicine, leaders in business, and absolutely form a new or create a new model for what life could be for Arabs in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, could be for Gazans. And in fact, I'll tell you just the English version of this term. The West Bank and Gazan Arabs refer to Arabs, Israeli Arabs, as the Arabs of the cream, meaning the establishment luxury Arabs who are very highly educated, who earn three times more than the average Arab middle class, if you will, across the region. And have privileges and freedoms in Israel that in other parts of the Middle East they don't have. So they refer to them sort of cynically as the Arabs of the cream. And I don't remember the Arabic name for it, but that's the translated concept. And so I think you're absolutely right. Israeli Arabs play an essential part, not only the Israeli story, but the Middle East story in a very positive sense.
So it's just one more example of, because we don't talk about them at all in the United States, it's just one more example of us putting our understandings, our beliefs, what we think is happening, and laying them on somebody else. We tend to look at the region as that part of the region as Jews over here and Arabs over there, and that's not right. So we have to hope that that will change, and maybe it will change. And you did a really good job, Dan, of getting us to what I like to do at the end, which is to look at optimistic scenarios, because I hate the thought of leaving on a pessimistic note, and especially in Washington today where it's cold and nasty and it may snow again. So I'm going to put something in front of you, and I'm going to ask you to respond to it. Israelis are dealing with a lot of horror. In a lot of ways, tragic losses in the military, the hostages, rocket barrages by Iran, rocket barrages by the Houthis. We didn't even mention the Houthis. We didn't even get as far as that or Syria. And the need to defend Israel from all of the angles, in all of the ways, including public affairs and ICC and, nasty politicians. Yet, in the 2024 world rankings of happiest countries, which was done in December of 2024, Israel ranked fifth. And among young people, Israel ranked second. Now, figure that out for me.
Israel is a country with a very strong identity. It's a country that has a strong historical identity. It has a strong cultural identity. It has a strong an identity of cultural that is based very much on resilience. It is based on the sense that we have a very profound, morally clear connection to this land for nearly 4,000, for well, more than 4,000, 5,000 years from Abraham, but 3,600 years as a national idea. Israelis are very, we're very optimistic people, forward-looking. That's what Startup Nation is all about. It's about optimism. It's about the possibilities that we have in our hand that we can make happen. It's about what they say, lizom, which means to initiate. It's a culture of initiation, of looking forward, of getting beyond the next obstacle. And I think that's what has helped us survive as a people, civilizationally, militarily. But it also forms a new pathway for hope and optimism. And I think the Abraham Accords are very much reflective of that. And I do think that my friend Hazem reminded me of this these last 2 weeks that we've been together, that the what's happened in Syria creates the possibility to benefit from Israeli optimism, Israeli technology, Israeli know-how, and that if we succeed in expanding the dimensions of the Abraham Accords to additional countries, which I believe are ready and have reached out to us at JCFA because of the optimism that you talk about. That's the optimism of Israel, and I think it can really spread through the Middle East and create a Middle East that is more secure, that is more stable, that is more optimistic, that is driven by the possibilities of peace and of a better future for the children of the region. That comes from Israel. And I think many in the Arab world either realize that or will come to realize that if Israel has the moral and political will to spread that optimism. So I do think it is a hopeful moment with all of the dangers and the difficulties that are inherent in the Middle East and to this extraordinary region, but a region of conflict and chaos. It can turn into a region that is far more secure and prosperous, and we have a very, very important role to play as a superpower not only firing rockets and in counterterrorism, but firing optimism and shooting it all around. I think we can do that.
So you get your superpowers and we get our superpowers. And maybe then to add to your optimistic note, the guys who brought you the Abraham Accords are coming back. The people who said you don't need a Palestinian state first, you need security and opportunity and economic growth and modernization, that comes first. And if the Palestinians want in, there was an avenue for them. Trump left them an avenue they chose not to take. Maybe this time they'll take it. So you have a moment in which Israel will be optimistic and will be the strong horse in the region, coupled with a moment when the other superpower has an idea about the future that doesn't involve old notions. Maybe we're good. Maybe
We
we're
are. We can be good, and I think that the Palestinians have got to change. It's all about identity. Natan Sharansky called it. It's his book on identity is such an important book, because it's all about how do you see yours? How do we see ourselves? And if the Palestinians can get out of this prison in which they see themselves as the only through the negation of their neighbor, of their Israeli neighbor, then they're going to have. Then they'll be able to overcome this decades-long psychological prison that is that really has been outfitted with sort of an outer wrapping of poisonous narrative that they can overcome if they follow the path of Abraham and the Saudis and the others in the Gulf and many other countries that are turning to Israel now. That's their challenge. That's their opportunity. And I do think that Israel has to use its new superpower status. Read that Jerusalem Post article today that came out about how we can help spread hope, optimism, and a positive pathway to a more secure and stable and prosperous Middle East.
I love it. We're going to stop there because if either one of us says another word, we're liable to ruin the mood you've just created for us. Dan Diger, thank you. It was outstanding. I appreciate it. I know our listeners appreciate it. We'll do it again, I hope.
I look forward to it again and again, and thank you for hosting me, and thank you for the great work of the Jewish Policy Center in Washington. It's really critically important.
Thank you, Dan.